Yeah, this is not Hancock and Kelly. If you were tuning in here on Campbell X to hear Hancock and Kelly this morning, they're not here, but yet they will be. Hancock and Kelly will be in on Camel X this afternoon from 1 until 5, I believe, an extended edition of Hancock and Kelly, because let's be real, who can't get more of Hancock and Kelly? So they are going to be on this afternoon. I'm Brad Young. I'm filling in for Hancock and Kelly this morning. And a lot of times at this very hour on Wednesday mornings, you hear me as my analyst in my analyst mode. And this, though, from 8:30 until 10 this morning, this is how I normally do At Your Service on Wednesday nights here on Camel X when baseball season is not in full swing, as they say. So I think I'll be coming back to Wednesday nights in October, since right now the playoffs chances aren't looking very good. So I should be back in early October on Wednesday nights. And this is really what we do on this show on Wednesday nights, and that is this. Think about right now, when you think of the idea of discussing politics, it's really just mudslinging, isn't it? And yet, what I try to bring to the conversation is not politics. What I try to bring to it is the difference between discussing ideas and throwing mud. And I love to discuss ideas. One of my favorite quotes is from Eleanor Roosevelt, and she said that great minds discuss ideas, average minds discuss events, and small minds discuss people. Well, think right now of every sound bite that you hear of the two candidates for president, or candidates for governor, or candidates for the Senate. What do you hear? Are you hearing them discussing ideas? Are you hearing them discussing events? Or are you just hearing them call each other names? Well, to me, calling each other names doesn't advance our knowledge about anything. I mean, you know, we called each other names when we were in grade school, but it didn't mean we were splitting the atom. So the idea is, I love to discuss ideas, and we'll be doing that between 8:30 and 10 o'clock this morning. But before I get to the ideas, though, listen, yesterday, I always love this, where there's this magical, and I don't know who picks these things, but yesterday was Talk Like a Pirate Day, and I don't know who picks them, but that's what it was yesterday. And I was reminded, which I got to tell you a quick story. I was reminded when my I've got three daughters, even my dog is female in my house, so I'm very outnumbered. So you can pray for me for that. But when my daughters were younger, we went to Disney World. And when we were at Disney World, there was this, it was a Monsters, Inc. exhibit. And you could submit material that Mike Wazowski would be telling as a comedian. And so I got the chance to submit my entry. And this was my entry. The joke that I gave was this. It was, where do pirates go when they go on vacation? Orlando. Okay, well, that's a cringeworthy joke, right? But it seems to fit within Talk Like a Pirate Day. But here's the big deal that I constantly remind my daughters, is that they pick my joke to be performed at Disney World. So yes, I can stand here before you this morning and tell you that I've had material performed at Disney World. Now, how much did I get paid for that material? Well, don't ask that. That's not the right question. That's irrelevant. Is not relevant to anything that we're talking about this morning. We are going to be talking about ideas. And when we come back from this particular break, what we're going to dive into is two ideas about the wastefulness of government, but also about free speech, because there are some fundamental misunderstandings today about what free speech is. We see it. It's constantly in the news. Whether it's on college campuses, whether it's in our grade schools, whether it's in our workplaces, or whether it's on social media, there is this constant friction, a dissonance when it comes to the idea of, is speech really free, or should speech be regulated for the good of community? And that's a big topic today. And I'm going to dive into both of those topics here before we reach the top of the hour here on Camo X, because, as you know, Camo X is the voice of St. Louis, and we will be talking about free speech this morning. Welcome back to Camo X. Brad Young in this morning. That's who I am. Filling in for Hancock and Kelly today. But again, you can catch Hancock and Kelly, like the four-hour Hancock and Kelly edition, this afternoon at 1 o'clock right here on Camo X. Before the break, I mentioned this idea of free speech, and I also, though, mentioned this idea of government waste. And I saw in the Post-Dispatch yesterday that St. Louis is spending cash that they received to try to boost businesses. And a lot of this money is coming from the federal pandemic and relief money to spur on businesses and local businesses. And of course, you're saying, wait, this is pandemic money and the pandemic is over. Yeah, that's right. Welcome to Government Analysis 101. The COVID event is over, but here we're still giving away money. In fact, $30 million St. Louis leaders are giving away for pandemic relief in an effort to spur local businesses. And first of all, that's a very laudable thing to do. Small business is the backbone of this country in terms of driving the economy, hiring individuals. Small businesses are where entrepreneurial start. My law firm here in town, Harris, Dowell, Fisher & Young, we're a small business. And so lots of small businesses obviously needed help after the pandemic. But here's the problem, and this is something, if it irritates you in any way as much as it irritates me, then we can commiserate together on this, because how often have we seen money that comes from the federal government squandered? Money that comes from state or local government that's wasted. It happens so often. And in this particular instance here in St. Louis, this $30 million, the Post-Dispatch did an amazing job. And normally, the Post-Dispatch and I don't always agree. I'll be completely honest with you. But here, I was rather surprised at the investigative journalism that they did, because what the Post-Dispatch did was they took that list of companies who are going to get this $30 million in federal pandemic relief money and started finding out who are these companies. And as they went to multiple businesses, I mean, some, obviously a significant portion, are heading towards intact, active organizations like the Urban League of Metropolitan St. Louis, well-known, the Boys and Girls Club of Greater St. Louis, excellent organization. But there were a lot of businesses that were basically in boarded up buildings that were going to get between $50,000 and $100,000. And so the Post-Dispatch goes to these buildings, takes pictures. There's no museum there. There's no incubator for small businesses there. In all of these instances, in fact, one was a broken down, dilapidated house covered with weeds. It was a two-story brick structure in the Ville neighborhood in St. Louis. It was empty. Boards were covering the front doors and the windows. The brick walls were cracked. They were crumbling. Windows were uncovered. There was holes in the windows. I mean, this is the kind of place, if you imagine, in It's a Wonderful Life. This is what they were throwing rocks at in It's a Wonderful Life. And this is supposed to be a business incubator that was going to get $50,000 in pandemic relief money. And you look at that and you just scratch your head and you say, now, wait a minute. This money doesn't grow on trees, right? This money is extracted from your paycheck every 2 weeks. This money is, you have to pay taxes on this money if you have any investments outside of your 401k plan or an IRA. This isn't just coming off the money tree. It's coming out of the wallet tree, and it's your wallet. And so to me, I'm particularly offended when I see these stories. Like, even, for example, the federal government announced just this week, they're getting new postal trucks. And you say, well, they need it. The ones they're driving now is worse than the vehicle that I drove when I was in college. And that was a pretty scary vehicle. Had an 8-track tape player, 1972 El Camino. That was not a jewel of a vehicle, I will tell you that. But the mail trucks are getting old, getting long in the tooth. So we need new mail trucks. But in typical government fashion, as I dug into this story this week, it looks like we're going to spend $5 billion to buy some new trucks, mail trucks. And when you spread out the cost and you come up with a per cost average, the per cost average for these vehicles, these mail trucks, is going to be $66,000 for every mail truck. Now, for comparison, if you would go out and buy a Mercedes-Benz, a Mercedes-Benz has something called the E-Sprinter, which is very similar to this mail truck that's being purchased by the federal government, right? But it's a Mercedes-Benz. But this Mercedes-Benz E-Sprinter, we could be having our postal people driving in style in a Mercedes-Benz. And those would only cost $59,000 per unit. But because of the way government designs things, the way the government bids out the process, it's going to cost over $66,000 for every one of these trucks, which is $7,000 more than if they all bought Mercedes-Benz trucks. And you look at that and you say, why in the world do things work like that? Why is it? Why is government so wasteful? And as I thought about this issue yesterday and this morning, I jotted down a couple of ideas that I think will resonate with you as far as why is our government so wasteful. I mean, for example, the government has gotten so huge, particularly our federal government, but even at our state and local level, governments grow faster than my waistline at an all-you-can-eat buffet, okay? They just get bigger and bigger. But there's no types of watchdogs that keep track of all of this federal spending. We also have this idea, and I deal with this in my legal practice all the time. It's so easy, isn't it, to spend other people's money? I mean, let me give you a great example. Great example. My oldest daughter, when she was about 6 or 7 years old, she wanted to go to a roller skating party. Okay, so I drop her off at the roller skating rink and I give her a $10 bill and I said, Catherine, here is $10. This is for your lunch today. You have to buy a hot dog, a soda, and a bag of chips. This is your lunch money. Don't buy anything stupid, okay? So then I come back at like 1 o'clock to pick her up from the roller skating rink party. And what happens? She comes out, and you've seen these things. They're called Billy Bob teeth. And Billy Bob teeth are these dentures, in essence, plastic dentures that look like you have missing teeth. They've got teeth that are sticking out, and it makes you look like a hillbilly. They're called Billy Bob teeth. And I said, Catherine, I told you to spend that money on your lunch. I told you not to buy anything stupid. And she said to me while wearing the Billy Bob teeth, but Dad, Billy Bob teeth aren't stupid. And, you know, that was a great life lesson that it's always easy to waste somebody else's money. And don't we see that right now at the federal level, at the state level, and even at the local level? That's why we need to hold our elected officials accountable. And in the minute we've got left here, or the few less than that, actually, think about this. Without a profit motive, there is no incentive. There's no incentive for the federal government to be innovative, to be creative. Think about SpaceX. They figured out a way to drastically drop the cost of space launches by exponential numbers. That's private industry innovation. The government never would have done that, and yet the private sector was able to pull that off. Hey, coming up in the next hour, we're going to be talking about this legal battle over artificial intelligence in movies. And there's one case that's getting ready to go to trial in particular that I want to talk about because it's fascinating, the idea where tech and the law collide. More on that on KMOX after this. It's not Hancock and Kelly this morning. We've got a double dose of Hancock and Kelly this afternoon coming up at 1 o'clock here on KMOX. Brad Young sitting in for Hancock and Kelly this morning. And as I mentioned before the break, one of the most fascinating legal topics today is dealing with AI and tech issues. Because in so many ways, if you think about it, the legal system in our country moves at a glacial pace. It always has. In fact, I would argue that it moves a whole lot faster today than it did in years past because of technology. And yet, even though we have those improvements, the legal system moves very slowly. So you have tech that races ahead. You have tech that presents us with issues, problems, conundrums, victims. All of those things come out because of tech, oftentimes. And then it takes the legal system years to catch up, to play catch up. And by the time they catch up to where they were, the tech has moved on to something else. Okay? We saw that. Oh, my goodness. Going back to the 1970s and 80s, we saw that in the whole battle between VHS and Betamax. And we saw this classic battle about whether or not you could record things off of television. Whether that I don't know if you remember, I was a kid then, but we had those. You could actually record on TV on these huge tapes. And they were, and you could watch TV. It was the first time you could ever make television conform to your schedule. And of course, now we take it for granted. But that was a big deal in the 70s and 80s. And yet the content producers said, whoa, 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 wait a minute here. You're recording our copyrighted material? You can't do that. And so lawsuits were filed, but it took the better part of a half a decade to get those issues resolved. Well, we've got the same thing going on today when it comes to artificial intelligence. Now, I love Star Wars movies. I love Star Trek movies. Okay, I'm a nerd. I admit it. But there was a great movie that came out in 2016. It was called Rogue One. And it was one of these Star Wars sequel movies. And it was, at least from my assessment, it was like one of the best of the Star Wars sequels movies that have come out. It was fantastic. It was its own central story. You didn't really have to know everything that was going on before or after the movie in the timeline. It was very good. It was excellent. But one of the scenes that was rather striking when I was sitting in the theater and I'm watching Rogue One, and if you saw it, you probably experienced this exact same feeling when the character Grand Moff Tarkin shows up on one of the Star Cruisers. Because that character was played by the legendary Peter Cushing in the original Star Wars movie going back to 1976. And I thought, how in the world did they get this guy to look like Peter Cushing? Because obviously Peter Cushing died in 94. I mean, he couldn't be in the movie without a Ouija board. So they had to do something, right? Well, here's what happened. And here's why that's relevant right now. Because Peter Cushing's family gave permission for Disney to digitally recreate Peter Cushing's face for this character. However, there's this other company. It's called Tyburn Film Productions. They claim that they had an agreement that they personally paid for the rights of Peter Cushing's image after death, and that they received this from Peter Cushing before he died. So now we've got this battle. Who owns the rights to the image of someone who died in 1994? I mean, that's a crazy legal issue. And yet it's valid. Why is it valid? It's valid for two enormous reasons. First of all, money. Okay. Rogue One grossed over $1 billion. So if you can make the argument that at least some of that money came because of you, Disney, stealing the image of Peter Cushing, because me, plaintiff, Tyburn Film Productions, I bought the rights to Peter Cushing's death image, and you recreated that, violating my contract with Peter Cushing, therefore you owe me big money. And that's the argument. But the flip side of the argument is that, number one, Disney said, well, we got the permission from the family. But secondly, and more importantly, Disney said that they had an original contract. Lucasfilm had an original contract with Peter Cushing going back to 1976 that said that Lucasfilm owned the rights to that character, Grand Moff Tarkin, portrayed by Peter Cushing. So here we have the battle of lawyers over the issue of, can you digitally recreate someone's image after they die? And who owns those rights? So the big issue is money, but the secondary issue is this. Moving forward, imagine if you will, there could be, with technology today, it's not a stretch, you could have a new John Wayne movie come out. How about Steve McQueen? Or you could have an Elizabeth Taylor movie come out. I mean, the possibilities are endless, what you could do by digitally recreating the image of past movie stars. But who owns the rights to those images? Who owns the right to those when the people died? Because when they signed movie contracts, particularly in the 50s or 60s or 70s, no one envisioned this idea that in the future people could recreate someone's image for the purpose of being in a movie. And yet today, it's not that hard to do. It's very easy to do because of technology. But the legal industry is way behind on that issue. So this case, filed by Tyburn Film Productions in London, has been scheduled now to go to trial. It's probably going to go to trial either before the end of the year or the very beginning of next year. Now, this is in England. It's not in the United States. But this was one of the issues that caused the SAG-AFTRA strike early this year, and that issue blurred the lines and really kept Hollywood out of production at the beginning of 2024 because of concerns over AI. How do we use AI? How do we use AI in terms of writing scripts or producing movies? And here we have the AI imagery over that. And then we've got a lot of other AI litigation going on right now in this country. There are companies that are suing chatbots, not chatbots, but AI bots, because the way they glean through terabytes of data on the internet to learn how to write. If you've ever gone to ChatGPT, it didn't just learn how to do that on its own. It had to read through tons of information to learn to do that. And people are suing ChatGPT saying, hey, that's our content that you've copied. So this is a burgeoning legal issue that could literally impact how we make movies, how movies are produced, how movies are viewed. And from our viewing perspective, whether we're going to see old movie stars coming back and doing new movies, all of that is encompassed in this litigation. Hey, we're going to take a break here. When we come back, we're going to continue a little bit of the tech talk, because you may have heard that there is a Chrome Google exploit out there, and you've got a deadline. In fact, that deadline was yesterday to update your browser. Why do you need to do that, and what happens if you don't? Joining us next, George Rosenthal, owner of ThrottleNet, next here on The Voice of St. Louis, KMOX. Yeah, that's right. Not Hancock and Kelly this morning. Brad Young sitting in for John Hancock and Michael Kelly. And joining us this morning, my good friend George Rosenthal. Hey, George, how you doing, my friend?
Very good, Brad. Thanks so much for having me on. Good to talk to you. And I agree, Rogue One was the last great Star Wars movie ever.
It was good, wasn't it?
It was fantastic, and then it all went downhill.
It did. And the other one, you know, listen, I could sit through a Star Wars movie, whether it's good or bad, but none of those subsequent movies really got to me either emotionally or intellectually as much as Rogue One. And
100%.
Oh, good. We're on the same page. Well, we're on the same page about a lot of things. In fact, I need to mention before we dive in, full disclosure, ThrottleNet handles the IT for my law firm. Love them. And I just needed to get that out there just so everybody knows that that's where we are. But I wanted to talk to you, George, because U.S. cyber officials issued a deadline this week for anyone who uses Google Chrome to update Chrome in order to patch some vulnerabilities. Now, I want to start very basic here. What's a vulnerability when it comes to a browser? What does that even mean?
This is any type of area where a bad actor can find a way into your system to do bad things, meaning they found a loophole in the code, or they found a way that if they can get you to a certain website, they can get some code on your browser that they can do something terrible and take over your systems or download malware and basically end up doing some bad things. But it's just vulnerabilities. And this happens all the time. Of course, you have security patches every day from Microsoft and everybody else, Apple and so forth. But these are some pretty dangerous vulnerabilities that are out there. And this also, by the way, does take effect for Microsoft Edge users as well. So even if you're not using Chrome, if you're using Microsoft Edge, everything we're talking about here, you definitely want to go and update Microsoft Edge as well.
And before we get to how we update, because I want you to walk us through how that works, George, but there's something, and this is something that I follow in my nerdiness and geekiness, is something called a zero-day exploit. And that's, of course, a zero-day exploit is something that a vendor has 0 days to fix because they don't know anything about it. So how do these work? Isn't it the fact that a lot of these vulnerabilities, whether it's with Windows or Google Chrome or our Edge or any of the other software packages that we use, aren't these vulnerabilities discovered by basically hackers and then traded on the dark web?
Many times they are. I would say a majority, yes. Of course, the developers are trying to find as many of these vulnerabilities as they can. There's ongoing testing internally at all these different companies. But yes, if a hacker finds a way to get into something, they are then spreading that all over the dark web, and then people are using that. But they're using it very quickly, which is when you mentioned 0 day. It's all about time. Once you find that vulnerability, it's a matter of how bad can you make damage before it's fixed. I mean, some of these things are really bad to where they're manipulating people's devices. They're stealing their passwords that are stored within Google Chrome. So if you're storing your passwords within the web browser, I would highly recommend not doing that. So where your browser will pre-populate your mailing address or your password, your usernames, I'm highly recommending you not store those in Google.
And there's an alternative, because it's funny, during the break, Frank Ladd and I were commiserating over how we have to have a different password for everything these days. Aren't there third-party apps that we can use to help us keep track of all of our various passwords?
Absolutely. I am not a reseller, but I will say that LastPass is my favorite of all that I've ever used. LastPass goes on every single device, computer. It has a browser extensions where it will actually remember and encrypt all your passwords for you. It actually creates all of your passwords. So all you have to remember is one master password, and then LastPass will then create all the rest of your passwords encrypted, and you never even know what the passwords are for your bank or credit card, website, or anything like that. And it's off-site. It's not part of the browser, which is great.
That does sound like something that we could all use to help us juggle these passwords. We're talking to George Rosenthal. He's the owner of ThrottleNet. And George, we've laid the foundation here about that there's these zero-day exploits, that there's vulnerabilities in Google Chrome. But now as we bring it on home here, how do people update something like Google Chrome? Because for those who aren't necessarily computer savvy, that could sound rather daunting.
Yes, it's actually very, very, very simple. So when you're opening your browser, if you're on your desktop, okay, you're going to go to the actual word which says Chrome in the upper left-hand corner. So you'll see, of course, a menu options like File and Edit and View. But to the far left is the word Chrome. If you click on that and go down to About Chrome, it will then tell you if you're up to date or not, and you can just click a button to update it. The key here with updating is that when you update the browser, be sure to close the browser. It may not tell you to do that. Close the entire browser even if you have multiple windows open. Close it all down and then restart it. It's very, very important that you do that. Same thing with Edge. Make sure you restart it. You're going to go to the About and make sure you click Update. Sometimes people on your phones, you'll have a three-dot button, and you'll do the same thing. Click the three-dot button, go to Help, then go to About. You want to make sure you... Yep, go ahead.
Yeah, I know whenever I saw... this is something frequently because I use Chrome every day. And sometimes, even when we don't know in advance that there's some sort of an update, there'll be kind of, at least on my version of Chrome, it's in the top right corner, but it says... Click here to update. I mean, it's literally just click on it, which shuts down the browser and then restarts the browser. They really make it easy to do, don't they?
Yes, they do. And what's important, though, is you actually do it. I know a lot of people may be listening. They're at work or maybe in the car. As soon as you get to your office, you need to update it at your office as well as your home. So these are vulnerabilities that can greatly affect your business. So it's extremely important that you update all the browsers in your company as well as just your home.
Yeah, because you probably see, George, as you're working in business environments where folks leave their computers on all the time, and if they've got the browser on, they're not necessarily going to exit out of the browser at the end of the workday. They may just leave it on and turn their monitor off. So it could be that if someone hasn't turned off their browser, again, whether that is Google Chrome or Microsoft Edge, that they could be exposing their company, or even if they're leaving it at home, leaving it on and open at home, they could be exposing themselves to hackers.
100%. In fact, one of the most dangerous things that CISA, the government security agency, said that they are doing is when you open up a video conference within the browser, they are recording and watching your video conferences through these vulnerabilities and then learning more about your business in order to get into the network. So that's called social engineering, of course, but that's one thing that's very dangerous. Is that if you're having a web conference or a video conference within the browser and they are already in, they're watching you and writing things down about your company. So it's very important that you upgrade Edge and Chrome immediately today in your business and at home.
My Zoom calls are so boring, George, it would probably kill the hackers. It would bore them to death. Is what it would do. George Rosenthal, the owner of ThrottleNet. George, very quickly here, if folks need more information about how they can update their businesses or homes to make sure they're as secure as possible, how can they reach you?
You want to go to ThrottleNet.com/KMOX. It's ThrottleNet.com/KMOX. There's actually a tour of the dark web on that page if you're interested in seeing what's out there on the dark web and what it looks like.
Very good, George. Great, as always, to talk to you, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you. You as well.
Hey, we're going to take a break here. When we come back, we're going to continue the nerdness today because we're going to talk to a real live astrophysicist. His name is Dr. Ryan Ogliori. I usually reach out to him on Wednesday evenings when there's stuff going on in space. He's the guy, and we'll be talking about the James Webb Space Telescope 2-year anniversary. We'll dive into that next on KMOX. Welcome back to what we would normally say is the Hancock and Kelly Show. Hancock and Kelly are going to be in this afternoon here on KMOX 1 to 5. So you can get your fill of Hancock and Kelly this afternoon, 1 to 5. Brad Young sitting in. And I was reading this week about, we just passed the 2-year anniversary for the James Webb Space Telescope. And I wanted to reach out to a guy who's become a friend of mine. I've reached out to him over the years on my Wednesday night show on At Your Service. His name is Dr. Ryan Ogliori. He's an astrophysicist at Washington University. Dr. Ogliori, it's great to talk to you again, sir.
Yes, great to be back. Thank you.
You do a fantastic job because I've talked to people that know a lot about science-y issues, and yet they're not very relatable. You are, and that's why I wanted to talk to you, and I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule today, because just this week I was reading that the James Webb Space Telescope captured a detailed image of a pair of galaxies that were colliding 465 million light years from Earth, and I wanted to reach out to you since we've just passed this 2-year anniversary, and just to ask, in case people, you know, they read this, they don't know obviously much about the James Webb Space Telescope, how is it different from, say, the Hubble Space Telescope?
Yeah, James Webb is different primarily because it looks in different wavelengths of light, so different colors, if you will, and it's looking in really, really red, so red that we can't see it. It's called the infrared. And this part of light, of the electromagnetic spectrum, is very important because it's where gas molecules vibrate. It's kind of where they dance, if you will, and where dust kind of glows. And in this regime, we can see chemistry. So we can see space chemistry. And that's why I'm super excited about James Webb, is that it can probe the parts of the universe that are invisible to Hubble, because Hubble can't go to those lower energies, those longer wavelengths, where gas molecules and dust particles become visible.
So it's not really a competitor, if you will, to Hubble, but it's a companion because they're looking at different spectrums of light. Is that fair to say?
That's right. And different physics happens in different spectra. And down here, we get into chemistry of molecules and rocks. You get into geology. you go to X-rays to higher energy, and you look at different types of events. And so you're probing really different events in the universe and in the solar system.
But it also, when you're probing these different events, doesn't it also, even if you're looking at an event that might be something that Hubble could see, when James Webb looks at these events, it might see details and information that is vastly different than what Hubble could pick up.
That's right. Yeah. And so with these colliding galaxies, like it's a super cool picture. Everybody should go look at it. It kind of looks like a smiley face. So what we're seeing is like a lot of the dust, like organic rich dust and gases that are involved in this collision. And we're seeing what's happening with that stuff. It gets dispersed, it gets concentrated. And the important thing is that feeds into stars forming. And so when these galaxies collide, it's unimaginably big scale, right? And it either depletes or enriches the regions where stars form. And so you can make stars, and we know that half these stars have planets. And so this affects everything, the kind of life cycle of stars, formation of planets, and everything.
And when we are seeing this information coming from 465 million light years from Earth, aren't we in essence using a time machine to see backwards in time?
That's right. Yeah. And that's what Einstein taught us, is space and time are fundamentally linked. And so when we look to things very, very far away, we're looking back in time. So that is, yeah, exactly like using a time machine to go back to that time period.
We're talking to Dr. Ryan Ogliori, astrophysicist at Washington University. And as I mentioned, we just passed the 2-year operational anniversary of the James Webb Space Telescope. But tell us, where is this telescope actually positioned? I mean, we've seen photographs of Hubble and photographs of when the people went up with the space shuttle to repair it, but where is James Webb located?
Yeah, so James Webb is not close to us like Hubble, so if it breaks, we can't fix it. It's at what's called a Lagrangian point, and so it's where the gravitational forces kind of balance, but it's not a stable balance. And so James Webb has to keep its orbit kind of close to that Lagrangian point. The rocket that took it there did a pinpoint landing, essentially, of the telescope in that spot. And so it will stay there for a nice long time. So it's far enough away that we can't fix it like we did with Hubble when we essentially corrected its optics. So it's a bit farther away. It's very cool, which is necessary to see this infrared light that we're interested in.
But that's about 1 million miles. That Lagrange point is about 1 million miles from the Earth, isn't it?
That's right. Yes, very far away.
Right. I just want to make sure that folks don't think it's just, in the next orbital belt or something. It's pretty far away, which in of itself to me is fascinating that we placed a space telescope in space, in orbit, 1 million miles from the Earth, and we're using that to see into hundreds of millions of years into the past. It's amazing science going on here, isn't it, Doctor?
Yeah, it's incredible. And it's an engineering victory for sure. Like, this thing had to unfurl itself way out there. And there are so many things that can go wrong. And space is so hard because we can't replicate the conditions here on Earth like an engineer would want to do. So you send these things out like landing a rover on Mars. You know, you can't replicate that landing here on Earth, and you have to do your best and see if it works. And it's really shocking to think about how this worked essentially flawlessly. It's amazing.
Well, and I want to change topics for a moment, because the last time we spoke, you and I had talked about something called Project Prometheus that you are working on and pitching to NASA. To me, this is amazing. Tell us about this Project Prometheus.
Yeah, so we are hoping to return samples to Earth from one of Jupiter's moon, its volcanic moon Io. So if you look, my main thing is thinking about the planets and what we've learned from bringing samples back from the planets and the moons in the solar system has really revolutionized our understanding. Like, we brought samples back from the moon, and we knew then that the Earth and the moon, the Earth formed from the moon colliding with a Mars-sized body 4 billion years ago. It's really shocked and revolutionized our understanding of the solar system.
Yes.
So we want to go out to the Jupiter system and fly through a volcano on Io. It sounds dangerous, and it is, and bring back essentially ash to Earth to study in the labs.
Well, I remember back in February that a NASA probe called Juno flew, I think it was a little less than 1,000 miles away from Io, and snapped some amazing pictures of these volcanic plumes. So is that the focus of your project Prometheus at WashU?
That's right, yeah. And we're named Prometheus after the Prometheus plume on Io, which is a volcano. You can think of like the fire fountains in Hawaii ejecting, but they're much bigger. They go up to 75 miles high. And this one's been going at least since 1980 and probably hundreds of years before that. So this one, it's kind of the old faithful of Io, and it's called Prometheus. So we're hoping to sample from that one. But if another one is active at the time, we can sample from that as well or instead. So there's always 10 of these things going off on Io at the same time. It's an amazing volcanic world in the outer solar system.
And just so we're clear, Doctor, we're going to wrap this up, but just so we're clear, then your project, if approved, would not only study that ash, but bring it back to Earth for additional study.
Yes, and so we can measure isotopes with part per million precision. We basically know nothing about how planets formed in the outer solar system, if you ask me, because we don't have a sample. And this, I would do the same thing as if, what we learned about the moon by bringing the Apollo samples back. It'll change completely our understanding of the outer solar system.
Wow. Last question, Dr. Oglioli. How long would it take, if this project gets approved, how long would it take to travel from Earth to Io, collect the data, and then bring it back?
It would take, 6 years there, 3 years around the Jupiter system, and then 3 years back if we're using the Falcon Heavy recoverable, and maybe some people have seen the Falcon Heavy land those boosters on the ground.
Wow.
If we can pay a little more and use the Falcon Heavy expendable, which uses all the fuel and dumps the boosters in the ocean, we can get to Io in 3 years, which sounds good to me because none of us are getting any younger. So we'll see about that.
Dr. Ryan Oglioli, astrophysicist at Washington University, thank you, my friend, for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us here today on KMOX.
Yes, thank you. Anytime.
We will be in touch. Hey, after this break, we're going to talk about, he's at WashU, we're going to talk about free speech on campus, but also violence on campus, the troubling trend of violence on campus, and how it all comes out of a misunderstanding of what the First Amendment says. Brad Young sitting in for Hancock and Kelly on The Voice of St. Louis. We're sliding into the last segment here of what is normally Hancock and Kelly. They'll be on from 1 to 5 today. Brad Young sitting in here for the remainder of the hour and sitting in a little bit next hour with Chris and Mike Claiborne as well. As I teased before the break, though, there's a real issue today when it comes to free speech on campus. What does free speech mean? Does it mean you have the right to camp out and protest on campuses, put up barriers, order pizza and Grubhub deliveries for days on end while you antagonize Jewish students? Does it mean that? Or does it just simply mean that you have the right to express your opinion, whatever it is, free from interference? And the reason why I bring this up is because yesterday, on a bipartisan vote, the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. passed what I think is the most comprehensive federal statutory protection rather, for free speech on college campuses ever. Now, this heads to the Senate. As most things do when it heads to the Senate, it's probably going to stall and not go anywhere. And yet, this is something that is critically important, particularly when we see how on campuses across the country, and even right here in St. Louis at WashU this year, we've seen these campuses rocked by protests over the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And a lot of this comes from a misunderstanding as to what the First Amendment says. We've all heard the First Amendment. We know what it means. Rather, we know what it says when we have the right to express our opinions. But that does not lead, nor has the Supreme Court ever inferred, that right means that you have the right to commit violence, to commit crimes. It never says that. So when you look at these protests across the country that we've been seeing on college campuses, and probably we're going to see more of that in the coming days and weeks as the presidential election comes, My frustration is that college campuses did not shut that down because they said, we're honoring free speech. But free speech doesn't mean you get to build a barrier, a wall, or a no-go zone for Jewish students. I'm not making that up. That exact fact pattern happened at UCLA last year. The Palestinian protesters set up an area where you could not go to the school library if you were Jewish unless you renounced your Jewish faith. Folks, I'm not making this up. And there was a lawsuit filed, and in the middle of August, a judge ruled in favor of the Jewish plaintiffs in this case. And here's what the judge said. And the judge, his words are so true, and yet it demonstrates the problem that we have today. Here's what the judge said. In the year 2024, in the United States of America, in the state of California, Jewish students were excluded from portions of the UCLA campus, because they refused to denounce their faith. This fact is so unimaginable and so abhorrent to our constitutional guarantee of religious freedom that it bears repeating. Jewish students were excluded from portions of the UCLA campus because they refused to renounce their faith, unquote. And the university took the position, well, you know, we can't do anything about it. These are third-party people. They're exercising the right of free speech. There's nothing we can do. And yet the judge issued a sanction against UCLA for not protecting the rights of Jewish students. And here's what I think is even more interesting. UCLA has appealed that order. In other words, they said, no, we don't want to protect the rights of Jewish students on campus. We want to allow protests to be violent and to discriminate against people based on their faith. And to me, I side with the judge. To me, that's unimaginable that that's happening. And it all comes from that fundamental misunderstanding of how the First Amendment works. So I had on my Wednesday night show, a caller once was disagreeing with me on this topic. And I said, do you think I should have the right to come to your apartment at 4 o'clock in the morning with a bullhorn and scream in your ear at 4 o'clock in the morning? And he said, no, of course not. I said, precisely. Thanks for agreeing with me on this topic, because it's private property and there are time and place and manner restrictions on the freedom of speech. Well, sure, we'll get into some of this and more next on the Chris and Amy Show on KMOX.